Well, hey, podcast family, and welcome to episode number 279 of the L3 Leadership Podcast, where we are obsessed with helping you grow to your maximum potential and to maximize the impact of your leadership. My name is Doug Smith, and I am your host, and today's episode is brought to you by my good friends at Bear Tongue Advisors. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. I'm so glad that you're here, and I hope that you'll enjoy our content and that you'll become a subscriber. Every month, you'll get at least two episodes from us. One will be a conversation that I have with a high-level leader, and one will be a personal leadership lesson from me that I know will add value to your life. So make sure that you're subscribed. And if you've been with us for a while, thank you so much for being a listener. It means the world to me. And just make sure that you're subscribed. And again, if this podcast has added value to your life, it would mean the world to me if you would share it with other leaders or leave us a rating and review. That really does help us grow our audience and reach more leaders. So thank you in advance for that. In today's episode, you'll hear my conversation with Ryan Hawk. And let me just tell you a little bit about Ryan in case you're unfamiliar with him. Ryan is a keynote speaker, author, advisor, and the host of The Learning Leader Show, a podcast with millions of listeners in more than 150 countries. He's also the author of Welcome to Management. He's a lifelong student of leadership, and he's actually risen to roles such as professional quarterback and VP of sales at a multi-billion dollar company. He's currently the head of Brixley & Myers Leadership Advisory Practice, and he also speaks regularly at Fortune 500 companies, works with teams and players in the NFL, NBA, NCAA, and facilitates leadership circles that offer structured guidance and collaborative feedback to new and experienced leaders. And I've been following Ryan for years now, and it was great to be able to sit down with him and have a conversation with him. And one thing that I didn't know, and I'm from Pittsburgh, and if you're from Pittsburgh, this is interesting. Ryan was actually playing football with Ben Roethlisberger in college, and they competed head-to-head, and I'll let him share how that story ended, but really, really interesting. You're going to get a ton out of this interview, but before we dive into the conversation, just a few announcements. This episode of the L3 Leadership Podcast is sponsored by Bear Tongue Advisors. The financial advisors at Bear Tongue Advisors help educate and empower clients to make informed financial decisions. You can find out how Bear Tongue Advisors can help you develop a customized financial plan for your financial future by visiting their website at Bear Tongue Advisors. That's BERATUNGadvisors.com. Securities and investment products and services offered through Waddell & Reed, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Bear Tongue Advisors, Waddell & Reed, and L3 Leadership are separate entities. I also want to thank our sponsor, Henny Jewelers. They're a jeweler owned by my friend and mentor, John Henny. And my wife, Laura, and I got our wedding and engagement rings at Henny Jewelers and had a wonderful experience. But what we really love about them is not only do they have great jewelry, but they also invest in and believe in people. In fact, every couple that comes in and gets engaged at Henny Jewelers, they give them a book to help them prepare for their marriage, and we just love that about them. So if you're in need of a good jeweler, check out hennyjewelers.com. And with all that being said, let's dive right into the episode. Here's my conversation with Ryan Hawk, the learning leader. Well, thank you, Ryan, so much for being willing to do this interview. And why don't we just start off with you just telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Okay. My name is Ryan Hawk. I try really hard to help people become more effective leaders. There's a number of different avenues and ways I do that. One, for my podcast, The Learning Leader Show. I've been doing it for 6 years, 415 plus of those things going now. Fortunately, it's gone well enough that, when I started the podcast, I was working as in the corporate America world. I was a VP of North American sales for a multi-billion dollar company. And it was going really well, but I came to kind of an inflection point about 3.5 years ago where I was going to have to either kind of slow down on the side hustle of my podcast and all of the cool things that were coming from it, or decide to leave that lucrative, high salary job for the more reckless path of doing my own thing. And I elected for the latter. So that's what I've been doing now for 3.5 years. Full-time when it comes to my podcast, and then working with leadership teams and leaders from an individual perspective, as well as all of the cool things that come from that, like keynote speaking, running leadership circles, and getting the experience and work with a variety of leadership teams in different industries all over the world.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that transition, because I know a lot of people listening to this are probably, they probably have full-time jobs. They've always dreamed of making a jump to something and maybe they're afraid to, or not sure if it'll work. You clearly did. And it seems like it's going pretty well. What would your advice be to people kind of processing that decision?
Well, I don't know if I'm the best for this, because I definitely have never had that dream. I never, ever considered leaving corporate America. I was in a pretty good position and had worked really hard to get to that position as the youngest VP in our company at that time. And so I, I know a lot of people thought it was stupid to leave. The whole purpose behind my show was I'd finished getting my MBA. I was at a director level at that time. My company paid for it. They reimbursed me, like a lot of companies do educational reimbursement. And I was looking to continue to go to school because I felt like I was wasting that money that my company would give me if I wasn't using it for some sort of educational reimbursement. And so I was looking and starting to apply for to get another graduate degree or even a PhD. And along the way, I was lucky to have a dinner with a guy named Todd Wagner. And Todd is Mark Cuban's business partner. They started broadcast.com together. And I went to the dinner early, and Todd did too before the rest of the group got there. And I just peppered him with questions the whole time. And he was gracious and kind and curious and humble and answered all of my questions. And as I was flying home from that trip, I just thought, like, is there a better way for me to go and create like my own form of a leadership PhD program and instead of going to school? And so that's why 6+ years ago, I launched my podcast, The Learning Leader Show, where it's my form of a leadership PhD program. I'm going to learn in public and I'm going to choose all the professors. And hopefully if it goes well, that not only will I get to learn, but others could learn along with me. And if that happens, then awesome, then I'm impacting others in a positive way. So I had no intention to leave. But, you know, after doing it for three or so years, I was just getting a lot of inquiries to help and do some work outside of my day job, to the point, like I mentioned, it was too much and I was left with a choice. And I had a good friend named Doug Meyer who wanted to support this and basically back me to do this. And that's what I elected to do. And so I kind of stumbled into it. I did not have any plan or intention or set a goal to do that. It happened, but I think that's part of why it happened was because the focus was just on the work. The focus was on producing good quality work that could help other people. And I think if you do that enough times where you're consistently putting something out, in this case, it's free because it's a podcast, but you consistently help enough people, they start reaching out to you to do more. And that could then start in a way becoming a business. And so that's when that became so much, that's when I thought, you know what, this is probably something I should consider leaning into. And that's what I did.
Yeah. No, thanks for sharing that. I didn't know all the details of that jump. I did want to talk to you a little bit about your career when you were in corporate. You know, you started off entry level as a sales rep and you ended up the VP of sales at a multi-billion-dollar company. No big deal. I'm just curious, what advice do you have for people first looking to climb the corporate ladder or want to grow in their careers?
So obviously you got to be excellent in your current role. Whatever it is that you're doing, be excellent, world-class in your current role. Do whatever it takes to be a top performer at that job. Those are table stakes just to get a chance to interview for the next job. Mm-hmm. However, the skills to do the next job well probably do not relate to your current job. So for example, in my case, a top performing sales rep does not mean you're going to be a good manager. Doesn't mean you're going to be a good leader. And that's the typical path for a lot of people if you want to go up from like individual to manager to director to VP, which is the path that I was on and that I went. So while you have to be excellent at your current job, on the side, you've got to be working on developing the skills to be excellent at the next job. And those are two completely separate things. They're really hard to do. It takes time, it takes effort, it takes work ethic, it takes perseverance and resilience so that when you then go for those jobs, the next job, you can prove that you've been working on that while at the same time excelling at your current role. Also, I would say the people who are making those decisions above you, who are going to hire the managers and the directors and the VPs, they usually hire people that they like and trust. And so I think it's a worthy investment of your time to begin developing relationships with people in positions that make decisions. So whether that's at your current company and other companies, that was a big part of what I was doing as well, was working to meet others who are in decision-making positions. And every job that I got promoted to, it's somebody who knew me at least a year prior to the job coming open. And probably actually now I think about it, multiple years, before the job came open. So they knew me, they knew my work, they knew what I had done. We had built a relationship. And so when the job came open, I had a better shot of getting it because I wasn't some random person they'd never heard of. So there's a lot that goes into it. Most people don't like that aspect of it, that they think like, well, they might kind of call it a good old boys network. But the reality is, think of yourself, if you're in a decision-making position, if you know someone that is a very high performer and you've known them for years, so you trust them and you believe in them, you're probably more apt to choose them over somebody that you don't know at all, over the unknown, even if their resume is great and they did well in the interview process. So if you're earlier in your career, think about that. Who are those people? Work to develop a genuine relationship with them. And I'd say you go to them with thoughtful questions to try to learn from them. And you got to kill it in your current role, to give yourself the best chance. And if you kind of combine all those things, it'll probably shake out in your favor. Now, I went for jobs many times and didn't get them. But I think that practice was also really good. I had to kind of figure out what I believed in and what I thought, so that when I got into the room to interview for leadership roles, I had some sense of an idea of what I was talking about. Versus at times when I'd go in there and, you know, I'm trying to say the things that I think they want me to say, and they can see through that really quickly. It's like, well, this guy hasn't thought it through enough. So I think all those things go into it. And then, you know, when the time is right and the people are right, then it gives you a shot to get those jobs.
Yeah. So you talked about making the jump from individual performer to manager to leader. And you actually wrote a book recently on this subject called Welcome to Management, How to Grow from Top Performer to Excellent Leader. Before we dive into a little bit about that journey, can you just talk about why did you write this book and what do you want leaders to get out of it?
So I wrote the book that I wanted to have when I got promoted. I got promoted young, 26 going on 27, and was a top sales performer in my company. And that then again was the table stakes to give me a chance to interview for the role to be a leader of the team that I was on. Because the job then was open when my boss had gotten promoted to another role. And I got the job partially because I was good as an individual contributor, partially because of my background in sports. And I was in leadership roles on the football field as a quarterback and team captain. But not really for anything that they'd seen me do at my company other than be a high performer as an individual contributor. And so what happened then when I got promoted is I was horrible. I had no idea what I was doing. I made mistake after mistake. I think there was an immense amount of luck involved for my team to somehow do well. I got a few lucky hires that those guys kind of helped build my team. But my goal for the book initially was just to help people not make the same mistakes that I did when I got promoted. I want someone who's earlier in their career who wants to get promoted, read the book to hopefully it helps to prepare them. I want someone who's newly promoted to read it. I want senior leaders to read it and give it to people who are new managers. So hopefully it can help them be better and not make the same mistakes that I did. And I think that makes it much more personal to me. It's my story to tell. It's, as my publisher McGraw Hill told me, like, this is, write the book that is unique to you, that only you can tell based upon your experiences and your learnings. And so I tried to combine what I've learned on my podcast as well as my own experiences. And that's kind of how the first book got put together.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about the age-old question of managers and management and leadership. Are managers and leader the same? Leadership the same thing? Can you have one without the other? I'm just curious your view on this.
What do you think?
What do I think? I think they're different, but I do think someone told me once that management is the path to leadership, and I do feel like that if you're going to grow, especially in a corporate organization or nonprofit, management has to be, you have to be a manager at some point along the way to actually learn those skill sets. I think eventually the management can be delegated, but I do feel like every young leader should have a management experience. So
yeah,
that's how I've been processing the question lately.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, management is there are certain constraints within an organization, within a business, within a nonprofit, and managing, you got to figure out how to manage within those constraints. I think that's a critical skill to develop. And I think from a leadership perspective, more higher strategic visionary type aspects of what it means to be a leader, Initially, you may not really have that, or you may not even need that for a frontline management role for your first one. Like, it can help, but you're also probably going to have to get in line with the vision and the mission of the people above you. So it's good to learn it as you're going, but you're really going to be managing the day to day and understand the metrics that matter and holding people accountable to those and holding yourself accountable to those. I think that's more of what the management is. And from a leadership perspective, now the other thing about it is, I think there are management titles. There are no leadership titles. So leaders, anybody can be a leader regardless of title from any place in an organization.
Yes.
Leaders are about people choosing to commit to you when they otherwise could choose to commit to somebody else. So that's really what leadership is all about, is like, who is actively choosing to commit to you. This is why the line compliance can be commanded, but commitment cannot, is a big part of my book and one of the most highlighted sections. Because if you think about any team you've ever been on, like, from a title perspective, you'll comply with somebody if you need the job and you need the paycheck and the benefits and you want to be there. You'll comply to their orders or whatever they're saying because you don't want to get fired. Commitment's a choice, though. You have to choose to commit to somebody. And I think the excellent leaders in the world are the ones who live in a way that they inspire others to choose to commit to them versus just complying to whatever they said because they don't want to get fired.
Yeah. In the book, you talk about every leader needs an operating framework. Can you talk about what that is and why leaders need one?
I was recording with a number of operators within a business that kept using that word or that phrase framework. And I was kind of staring at them being like, I don't even know what he's talking about. I vividly remember Ryan Caldbeck, who was the CEO and founder of Circle Up, and he kept saying that phrase and he kept using it and telling me the way he thought. I'm like, God, I don't even know what to say to this guy. And so after that, I really kind of went to work on like, what's my framework? What's my desire? What type of leader do I want to be? And I kind of like really just pulled from a lot of different areas. And for me, the phrase that really struck me that I think I really love came from Charlie Munger, you know, Warren Buffett's business partner, where he said, you know, you should strive to be a learning machine. You should strive to be a little bit wiser when you go to bed than you were when you woke up. And I thought, that's what I love. So my whole mission is to become a learning machine. And I created kind of four parts to it. It's not fully original, but it's mine for this sake. And that is the first part of that four-part framework for me on how to become and be a learning machine is I have to fuel my intake engine. And this is also the definition for me of a great day. Of a great day in this quest to be a learning machine. So the first part, I need to fuel my intake engine, right? I got to be reading books and listening to podcasts and meeting with mentors, really fueling the engine of what's coming in so I can always be in this learning mode. But two, I can't just be a learner. I need to be a doer. I need to take from theory to practice. I need to put it into play. So if I, you know, let's say met with a mentor and that mentor gave me advice on running better meetings, I then have to take what he or she told me and put it into practice. So my next meeting, I'm going to experiment with what that person told me. And then the third step, I'm going to take a step back. I'm going to reflect. I'm going to pause. And I'm going to say, what went well? What didn't from the experimentation that I did based upon the intake engine or the feedback or the knowledge that I'm gaining in here? And then I'm experimenting, then I'm reflecting to see what worked, what didn't, what should I keep doing, what should I stop doing. And then the fourth part, and I think really important, and this is why I lean into public speaking and other areas, is the one of the greatest tools in the world for learning is teaching. Think about any moment in your life where you've had to give a presentation, a keynote speak, a guest lecture at a local university or whatever. You're meeting with a mentee trying to help him or her. Think about the moments leading up to that, the test, the presentation, whatever it is. You're going to do, I would imagine, if you have pride, you're going to do a lot of work to prepare to get an idea of what you think. You're going to work to gain clarity of your beliefs, of your thoughts, so that when you teach it, you're going to hopefully impact the people you're teaching in a positive way. And on top of that, you're going to receive feedback from them and the people who you are teaching to see what really resonated with them. So you have that prep process, then you deliver the teaching, then you get the feedback. That is a huge tool for learning. And so for me, those four things make up a great day: fueling the intake engine, being an experimenter with what you're learning, reflect, analyze what worked and what didn't, what should you keep doing, what should you stop, and then teaching it to somebody else. Those four things, that's how I work to become a learning machine.
Yeah. So you talk about being a learning machine. I think myself included, a lot of people listening to this want to write a book. You've written one. I'm just curious, what did you learn from writing this book about the writing process?
So when I got the book deal from McGraw-Hill, I thought, well, I knew it was going to be hard. Writing books are hard. I know it's 60,000 words. It's a lot. But I didn't fully know how little I knew about my topic until I tried to write a book about it. And I think you have a lot of thoughts in your mind. You think you know what you're talking about, but then you try to get it from your head to the page. And then you look at it and you kind of hate yourself because it's not very good. And you got to go through so many edits and rewrites and edits and rewrites and back and forth. And so I just think that's why I think for all leaders, a great skill and a great practice is to write. It doesn't have to be a book. I mean, I think you should, if you're in a leadership role, I think your team needs to know what you're thinking. So you should, whether you're just writing them emails or you're publishing on a website or you're writing a book, the process of getting the thoughts and ideas from your head to the page is hard, and it will make you question yourself over and over and over. But then once you get it from here down to the page, you start gaining some clarity and belief and understanding, and really increases your self-awareness and your awareness of what you kind of know and what you don't. And so that's why I would just encourage people in general. I think effective leaders need to be very well read, and then they need to be good writers. They need to work on the craft of getting the ideas from their head to the page, as well as great communicators with their teams. And one of the great ways to do that is to write. So regardless of you're going to write a book or whatever, get the thoughts out from your head down to the page and work on crafting those messages to your team so that you can hopefully, inspire them in a different way by just the written word, which can be pretty powerful if you get good at it.
Yeah, well, I'll include a link in the show notes for the book. I hope everyone will go buy a copy of that. Being that I also host my own podcast, I'd be foolish not to dive in and ask you questions about podcasting and interviewing. Specifically, when it comes to podcasts for you, I actually use your guests as to help me fill my bucket list of people I want to interview. So, so thank you for that. You've had some incredible guests, and I was listening to your interview with Carrie Newhoff, and your answer blew me away. So I don't want to ruin it for people, but can you talk about your process for getting a guest and the lengths that you're willing to go to get them? Cause, I was just blown away.
I don't remember what I told Carrie, but I'll just tell you how I get guests. So maybe it'll be the same. So there's a wide variety of how I get them, but I think, at the beginning stages, it was 100% cold outreach. So sending cold emails, one of the helpful skills that I developed early in my career was when I was a sales executive, an inside telephonic sales rep for LexisNexis, we had to smile and dial and make a bunch of phone calls every day to get a hold of prospects to try to sell them our service. And we also had to learn email marketing and learn how to write compelling cold emails to generate responses. And so I've used some of those skills when reaching out to guests, and I also understand, use all the tools at my disposal, like my Outlook calendar, in order to make sure I'm following up. But in my case, I just try to be relentless, as not annoying as possible. So I will just continue to email and follow up and follow up and follow up as many times as it takes in order to get a hold of somebody. And I think to me, I'm just always on the lookout for people who I'm curious to learn more about their stories and them. And I want to have them on the show to really dig into those stories and ask them questions. So, I'm always on the lookout. I'm always willing to continue to follow up. I never take offense when somebody ignores me or says no, because they're busy. They got things going on. They're not thinking about me. It's not about me. It's no big deal. And I just keep at it. And I think, you know, one of my good friends who I've hired at a few places to work on my sales teams, he's still crushing it right now. And one of the jobs I hired him at my last company. And, I'm just like, if you had to like distill down your reason for why you crush it at every job, regardless of your sales territory, regardless of what you're selling, regardless of what company you're working for, he's just like, I think I'm really good at following up. I always am on top of the follow-up, whether it's a current customer, a prospect, or whatever it is. I just try to follow up. I'm respectful, but follow up. And I think, yeah, I kind of identify with that. I just try to always be following up with people, and keeping them in the loop as my show grows. Maybe, hey, it's worth it now. And some of these guys and girls who ignored me and didn't want to respond, or they said no, 3 years later, after a number of emails, maybe now is the time. And so that's kind of how I still go. It's different now because, you know, the show's at a place where the opposite happens now, where the PR people and the authors themselves or the leaders themselves want to get some, get their name out there a little bit more, or shine a light on whatever their initiative is, whether it's a book or their company. And so they typically then reach out to me, and then I kind of just figure out, okay, who of these people are the ones I'm really curious about in order to do a lot of research on, in order to record with them. And so it's a good mix now of incoming and outgoing requests to be on the show. But that's a really important part, as you know, to make sure that those guests are good and can tell good stories that are have practical application for your audience.
Yeah. Can you give people an idea of how many emails you may typically send someone? I think this was a stat that like blew me away. I don't know if it was a one-time thing or an average, but I'm just curious.
I mean, I'll go on forever. I'll go on forever. I mean,
If someone says no, you'll continue to follow up?
Of course.
Yeah.
I just don't believe in no. I just believe in not yet. So, I mean, in my early sales days, it was always there was no such thing as a no. It was just, and even today, when talking about from a business perspective with the people I work with, people say, well, how much revenue was lost in that month or that quarter, meaning like you had a proposal and you didn't get it. And I don't use that language. I say, well, 20K and not yet. You know, I just think like that's just how I view it. And I don't know, maybe I'm delusional, but in a way, like I think I understand that they're not really thinking about me. And so I just don't take it personal. My dad told me a long time ago when I asked him, like, what do you think of these pants? How do these look? When I was going to like a banquet, he's like, they don't care about your pants. They care about their pants. And so I just try to take that mentality towards cold outreach and cold emails. If they delete it or they ignore me or they say no, I'm just going to keep going. And I don't see much downside from that. As long as I'm respectful, you know, and I have genuine updates, I just copy and paste the same note. Like I try to give genuine notes. As long as I do that, I feel like the upside's much greater than the potential downside of somebody getting annoyed.
Yeah. And can you talk to me a little bit about the art of interviewing? How have you grown in 400 plus interviews as an interviewer?
So my prep process has changed from scripting questions to scripting potential topics. So whereas before, at the early, probably first couple hundred, I would script out questions to ask a person. Now I will have my notes are a series of interesting ideas or topics or things they have said or written about. And then I can look at those and formulate a question within the conversation based upon those topics. But I've also found, Doug, and I'm sure you've picked up on this for your show, the best questions are almost never the initial ones. They're always the follow-up questions. And so it's really about being an active listener, picking up on maybe emotional parts or really interesting aspects of a story, and diving deeper and going to the next level. I think that's where like the good stuff can come out. Doesn't work all the time. Nothing does, but I think it also is more enjoyable for the guests because maybe they're getting into areas where they haven't gone very much. Like I interview people who have been interviewed by a lot of people in some cases, so they can get tired of their own stuff. And so if I can get them out of that kind of interview mode and into more of a conversation, it seems like they enjoy it. And when they enjoy it, it's always a better episode for the listener. So there's a lot of good things that happen when my guests seem to have fun and they seem to enjoy what we're talking about. They're going to tell their friends, and they're also just going to be better guests for the listener. And then we have a chance to develop a relationship too, which I think is a great bonus out of doing this.
Yeah. You mentioned your dad's advice to you. I've been following you for a while, and it's clear that your dad's made a huge impact on your life, and your family seems really, really awesome, by the way, just from a distance. Can you just talk about your dad's impact on your life and maybe, you know, a lesson or two from your dad that, that influences the way you live?
Well, it's just funny. If you talk to me long enough, you can't help but hear him coming out in me. I try to give him credit for the things I learned from him, although I'm sure I'm stealing pretty much much more than the times I give him credit. No, I think from a parenting perspective, you know, my mom and dad have just been the incredible models for us. They've been supportive. They showed us what it's like to have a loving marriage. They show us what it's like to be a supportive but not snowplow slash helicopter parent, right? They let us fail. They let us figure things out. They let us kind of face some difficult things we had to work through on our own, but we know they're there if we need them. So I think that's what they've always done. My dad was, you know, a long time award-winning sales leader. He led 1,000 person sales forces. He's written multiple books about the profession of selling. He's started from a very modest means, I would say, growing up, and then built up a really incredible career for himself to now he's in a place where he advises, consults, he's on some boards, but he's essentially retired. He plays golf most days, and he answers whenever I call or whenever I need something. So I just say, it's like, he's the one who told me that your presence is required as a leader. And what he meant by that is, you know, as a dad, he tries to always was putting the coins in the machine when we were at the batting cages, to rebound when we're shooting baskets, to catch our passes in the backyard, run with us, play with us. Present, just be there, be present. And I think from a leadership perspective, I try to do the same as a dad, and in business, it's really the same thing. Like, your presence is required. Like, try to be there for your people, even if it's not physically now with what's going on in the world. How can you be present for your people when you're in a one-on-one meeting? Is your phone on the desk? Are you looking at it? Are you actually present with them? Is the TV on? Like, I've experienced all these things with a leader, and they may not even realize they're doing it, but to me, it's extremely disrespectful. Wow. It's not being present. So when I'm with you one-on-one, I am all, like when I said yes to this, Doug, I'm like, I'm all in on this for our hour together. Because if I don't think I can do that, then I'm going to say no, and we're not going to do it because it's disrespectful to you. And I think from a leadership perspective and things I learned, like my mom and dad, when they're with us, they're present, and they've shown us that that's how you show respect for people. That's how you care for people. And when you do that, I think the odds increase of the people that you're working with or your family responding better than if you're kind of 60% of yourself is there. And if you're all there, I think your odds are much better.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing those lessons. I know aside from your parents, sports have played a big part in your life as well. And actually I didn't know this until I listened to your interview with Carrie, but I'm from Pittsburgh, so obviously a big Steeler fan. But I'm just curious, can you talk about what you've learned from sports? And then for all those listening here in Pittsburgh, you've actually competed against some significant athletes in our city. Can you talk about that and what you learned from that experience?
Well, I mean, sports are growing up, I was, you know, again, fortunate to, get to play everything. So basketball, baseball, football, swimming, ping pong, tennis, whatever. We played it all like formally on teams. It was mainly basketball, baseball, football, and swimming. And as we grew up, still played all the sports. We're playing year round, and fortunately developed interest in football. I played quarterback from a number of colleges where I was offered scholarship. I elected to go to Miami University here in Oxford, Ohio, and the Mid-American Conference. And shortly after I committed to go to Miami, Ben Roethlisberger, now Pittsburgh's own, I would say, from Findlay, Ohio, but now I think Pittsburgh probably year round. Ben is my age. We're the same class, same position. We came in together and for 2 years just kind of battled it out. And during our second year at Miami together is when the late, great Terry Heppner pulled us aside. And I remember during the game when we were playing at the University of Iowa, and looked us both in the eye as we were both getting beat up because we were still rotating at the time, and said, he's going to be the starter. You're going to be the backup. You're not going to go in unless he gets hurt. I can't have you guys both getting hurt at the same time. And, you know, it's a devastating moment for me to have lost that. I've been a starter on every team of every sport I ever played, shortstop, point guard, quarterback, including my freshman year in high school on the varsity team. And so to have that happen, it's the first time ever that I had lost a starting job in any sport at any time in my life. And so it was just devastating. But I think the great learning from it is, sometimes you can put everything you've got into something and it doesn't matter. The world doesn't necessarily care. Somebody else will still be better than you. It's not like the coach made a poor decision. He made the correct decision, obviously. And but that didn't like ease the pain at the time. But when you have to go through those moments and figure out like, what am I going to do? Because I can, I can try as hard as I want. I can work as hard as I want. It doesn't matter. That person is better than me. And I think it's just good to learn that sometimes, because, and then decide, how do you want to respond? How do you want to respond in those moments? And for me, I didn't want to be a backup. I didn't want to play another position, which were both options on the table. I transferred to Ohio University. I didn't want to transfer. I still to this day have some of my best friends are from Miami. But I started all over at OU. And fortunately, I got to play for a few years, elected captain, and it gave me the opportunity to play after college, so play professionally. So I would say that's how I chose to respond, and that response then gave me more opportunity to keep playing and be the guy. I wanted to be a starting quarterback in Division I football, and that's what I did. So, but tons of learning from coaches, from setbacks, from adversity, from losing. I draw from all of that now on a daily basis.
You're a learning machine. So thank you for sharing that story. I didn't know the whole story, and it's so powerful how you responded to that. I want to transition the rest of our time into what I call the lightning round, just a bunch of fun questions I ask every interview. And the first one is, what's the best advice you've ever received and who gave it to you?
I think I was a freshman in high school. My dad sat my brother and me down, my younger brother, who's 2 years after me, but he's really good. And he said, if you guys choose to do anything of significance, you're going to have people who praise you and you're going to have people who criticize you. Just don't get too high from the praise and don't get too low from the criticism. Work to stay composed and even keeled through all of that praise and criticism if you choose. And if you can't handle praise and you can't handle criticism, then you can't really go for big things. So you guys kind of have to make that choice and keep a level head amongst all that. And I would say that left a mark on both of us, because we've both faced praise and criticism because we try to do big things. And I think that that's just helpful advice for anybody. If you can actually put it into action.
If you could put a quote on a billboard for everyone to read, what would it say?
So I think the opposite of, I got to figure out how to paraphrase this. So I'm going to workshop this with you real quick. And I'm thinking about this on the fly. You may have sent me these questions ahead of time and I didn't read them because I think it's better if you don't. I think the opposite of judgment is curiosity. And so I would urge people to approach people with curiosity versus judgment, and your life will probably be better, right? Get to know people, be curious, be interested in them versus trying to be interesting. I think you could maybe paraphrase that and put on a billboard, and that might be good.
What's the best purchase in the last year you made for $100 or less?
Maybe I should have read the question.
This one always stumps people.
I need to come back to that one. I can't think of that. I can't have one right now. I don't want to just say, I don't want to give something that's stupid, so I can't think of that one right now.
What's a book that's impacted you either recently or all time that you find yourself giving away most often or that you would give away?
The Wright Brothers by David McCullough is so they're from Dayton, Ohio. That's where I live. That's where I'm born and raised. Their bicycle shop is right down the street, and they're just, it's a remarkable story of people who were not nearly as supported as many others who were trying to create the first ever flying machine. And them with their sister, Catherine, they did it. You know, they kind of were against the odds. They're underfunded, undersupported, and yet they just kept at it. They go down to Kitty Hawk. They go on the sand dunes. They faced terrible adversity. People died as they're trying to get their flying machine up and stay afloat. And yet these dudes also would spend regular set amount of time standing on the dunes watching birds to try to mimic and build their wings of their airplane like the wings of a bird to keep it afloat. And I just think, wow, I love it. And so this right here is actually the patent, the print of the patent. I'm pointing for audio listeners to the patent of the first ever flying machine by Orville and Wilbur Wright.
Wow, that's really cool. Other than your own, do you have a favorite podcast or two that you'd recommend?
I'm looking at them right now. I would say Business Wars is a good one. I like those kind of the people who have super high production value. So I'd say Business Wars is really good, as well as my friend Brian Baumgartner. I've got to meet him a few times. He has the Office Deep Dive, which is a really good one. And then I don't know. I think Scott Galloway is a character. I listen to a lot of what Scott does when it comes to a personality. And then Brian Koppelman, the moment, he's, I think, one of the premier interviewers in the world.
What do you wish people knew about your journey that they may not know?
I mean, I have 400 some episodes out there. I think people know a lot now if they listen. I don't think people fully understand like everything that goes into consistently shipping work every week for 400 some in a row. I think they think like it's machine like, or like you just kind of get a system and go, and there's just a lot that goes into it. My wife could tell them like all the things that go into it, cause she sees me working. But I just think for all, and you know this, but for the stuff that you have to do, there's just a lot behind the scenes that you got to do to make it good.
Yeah. You've been asking questions. You're a master at it for a long time. Is there a favorite go-to question that you always ask, maybe in every interview or every time you get a lunch with a great leader?
I'm most curious. So, about what they found to be commonalities among leaders who have sustained excellence. So like as they have to look and think of the commonalities, I'm curious to hear what people think those things are. So what are the actions and behaviors and mindsets of leaders who have sustained excellence? And those two words are very important to me. I mean, the people who can perform at excellent levels and sustain it over time. I am curious to learn about how people have done that and what they do and how they think. And so that's a question I ask a lot of people.
Yeah. And what have you found in your 400 plus interviews as the answer to that question?
I think if I had to name a few things, first, they're extremely thoughtful and reflective people. They are willing to block time to actually think and reflect. And I think that also increases levels of awareness, which is a very important quality in a person, like a self-awareness and spatial awareness and awareness of others. I think it's really important. I think they act with intention and purpose. They don't wander haphazardly around the world, just crossing their fingers and hoping for the best. They act based upon their thoughts and reflections with intention and purpose behind everything that they do. There's a specific reason behind the things they say and do. And then they have a bias for action. They don't just sit back and talk about it. They go and be about it. They go and do it. There's a difference between talkers and doers, and I like the doers. I want people who are going to go out and do it. And so I'd say those are probably a few things that people who I found that sustain excellence seem to exhibit those behaviors.
What's your biggest leadership pet peeve?
So when you ask this question, I'm guessing like everybody has this thought bubble that pops up and there's a person that's in the thought bubble. And yeah. So I immediately can picture this guy, and I'm not going to say his name, but I'm just trying to pick of the like seven different things that he did.
Wow.
And that's what I'm thinking of. I would say, just selfish and didn't care about others. And so that is a huge pet peeve. If a leader is very selfish and doesn't care about other people, that's a rough one. You're probably going to, I feel like you're going to struggle. I don't know if you lead people and you don't really care about them. That's going to be a tough go.
I love that. No one has ever at least said out loud. I'm sure they've done it, but no one has said out loud that they had a person in mind in their thought bubble. So
how could you not?
You're absolutely right. That's beautiful. What's something you've done, maybe crossed off your bucket list, that you think everyone should do?
Swim in Lake Tahoe and the Adriatic Sea. I've got to swim in both of those bodies of water.
Where's the Adriatic Sea? I don't know.
I was in Croatia at the time, off the coast of Croatia. There are other countries I would imagine that are there. My geography isn't great, but that's where I was for a speaking event. And I go to Lake Tahoe every summer. Both bodies of water were very cold, but very cool. So I'd say I love to swim. So I would say if you can get, or just dunk yourself into those bodies of water, that'd be a cool thing to do. I feel fortunate to have done that.
Is there anything still on your bucket list that you haven't crossed off that you want to do?
Do you have a bucket list?
I do.
I don't. So I'm curious, like, what are some things that are on a bucket list? Maybe I should make one.
Yeah. So like, I want to visit all the major national parks. There's too many national parks to visit all of them. So that's on the bucket list. So I crossed them off. I want to attend every major, tennis event. And so I've done the US Open and I've done, Wimbledon. So I want to hit the Australian and the French Open up. So there's events like that. I want to attend a Super Bowl, all the major sporting events. Those are some examples.
What national parks have you gone to so far?
Yeah. If I had to rank them, Banff in Canada.
Yeah.
It's absolutely beautiful. Yosemite. My wife and I go to Acadia National Park every year. We got married and it's up in Maine. It's beautiful there.
When you go to these national parks, what do you do? Hike, walk around?
Yeah, we're hikers and bike if we can. So I would say a bucket list trip like that we loved when we did Yosemite. We spent a few days in San Francisco, biked all around the city, loved that. And then we spent probably 5 days in Yosemite, did all the major hikes you could do. And then we went to Napa Valley and just hung out a few days there. Like that's like the ultimate vacation for us. So a little bit of city, national park, like to relax for a while and hike.
Would you be willing to send me a note after we're done here of like, I'm terrible at this, but I think I want to be better at that exact thing on your bucket list when it comes to, I've done a lot of sporting things, but when it comes to national parks, like I think of Utah too. I think of other, I haven't done any of that stuff. I'd like to get more intentional about that. Would you do that?
Yeah, I'd love to. And I can send you the agendas that would
be awesome. Yeah. That'd be like the in order. And yeah, I think that'd be really cool to at least just to start like getting after that. Cause yeah, I haven't been very good about that.
Okay.
Do you have kids?
I do. They're young. I think they're younger than yours.
Do they go with you?
Yeah. So I have a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and then a 3-month-old. So we have, I forget what the company's called. I'll send it to you. They have these cool backpacks where they can just go on your back.
And, that's awesome.
Yeah. So our 5-year-old's getting to the point where she could walk, which is good, but I'm also like, is she going to, you know, bail halfway through the hike? So we have to figure that part out. But the backpacks have been huge.
That's cool. Okay. Yeah. So I'd love for you to send me any info you have on the national parks and like you, from your, I know I can Google that stuff, but I'm on it like from your experience. I think that'd be cool.
Yeah. Yeah. We've done a lot of research on that.
Cool.
A few more questions. If you could go back and have coffee with your 20-year-old self, what would you tell him?
I would tell him, focus on building relationships now. And don't be so into yourself and selfish. Think about other people, be interested in other people, build meaningful, mutually beneficial relationships now. Don't, you're an idiot and you're going to wait like 10 years. Don't do it now. That's what I would say.
I meant to ask this a minute ago, but do you have a bucket list of people you'd like to interview and who's at the top of that list since you've interviewed quite a amount of people? Yeah.
Dave Matthews is number one.
Wow. There we go.
I think he'd be cool. I'd like to do a panel with, I'd be sitting in the middle and on one side would be Tom Brady and Peyton Manning. And on the other side would be Aaron Rodgers and Patrick Mahomes. So that'd be one with a live audience. And then, probably like another one that would be me in the middle. And on one side, Elon Musk and the other side, Jeff Bezos, just to maybe see if they'd fight. That might be cool. And then I'd like to have a one-on-one with Oprah. I think that'd be neat.
Wow. That's awesome, man. Well, I look forward to having all of those things accomplished off of your interview bucket list.
Me
Let's
too.
Go. Let's
Me
go.
Too. Me too.
Last question would be, what do you want your legacy to be? What do you want people to remember you for?
I hope people, I guess, would think that I follow my curiosity and obsessions with great rigor, with the intention to help other people. You know, I think that'd be cool if they said, hey, he seemed to be really curious and care to get to know people and their stories. And through those, through the actions of following that curiosity, that it helped a lot of people. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Anything else you want to leave leaders with today?
No, I mean, Doug, I appreciate the prep and you being so good at this. It makes it a lot more fun for me. So I'm good.
Hey leader, thank you so much for listening to my conversation with Ryan Hawk. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. And you can find ways to connect with Ryan and links to everything that we discussed in the show notes at l3leadership.org/279. And as always, if it added value to your life, it would mean the world to me if you would share your key takeaways on social media or send this lesson to 3 to 5 other leaders that you know it would add value to. Again, that helps us grow our audience and reach more leaders. So thank you in advance for that. And leader, I say this all the time, but I believe it. If you want to 10x your growth this year, then I really want to challenge you to either launch or join an L3 Leadership Mastermind Group. Mastermind groups have been the greatest source of growth in my life over the last 6 years. If you're unfamiliar with what a mastermind group is, they're simply small groups of leaders, usually 6 to 12, that meet together for at least 1 year in order to help each other grow, achieve their goals, and to do life together. If you're interested in learning more, you can go to l3leadership.org/masterminds. And as always, I like to end every episode with a quote. And today I'll quote Dave Ramsey. He said this, I think it is pretty cool that you can just decide to change your life. Make today the day. Leader Laura and I love you so much. We believe in you. Keep leading, keep making a difference, and we'll talk to you next episode.